Mr. Maytag, repairman.
I'm coming. I'd go anywhere to fix a Maytag.
Wow, what a dream. But I'm exhausted. I better go down to the shop and get some rest.
Not all Maytag repairmen are this lonely, but we're trying. Maytag, the dependability people.
Let's talk about a few big numbers. In the 1970s, a U.S. consumer would see around 500 ads per day. In 2019, that number was 5,000. Some 30,000 new products make their way to online and brick-and-mortar stores each year. That's 30,000 new products in addition to the nearly 12 million products for sale online through Amazon alone. How consumers decide which of the 12 million products to purchase is one of the most important questions in business today. We need help sifting through the possibilities and the potential purchases. More than that, we need to know who to trust. Advertisements are a great way to hear about new products, but how do we know if we can trust what we are seeing? This is why influencer marketing is an $8 billion industry. Influencers build trust with an audience, maintain an authentic voice, and share their likes and dislikes in a public forum. It is a great leveling force in purchase decision-making today. There's a catch, though. In order to stay authentic, influencers have to believe in what they're sharing. But where do you find such influencers with which you may peddle your wares? Well, you're in luck. There's a marketplace for that. I'm Robert Murphy, and you're listening to That Changed Everything. Hi, everyone. I'm Robert Murphy. Thanks for listening to That Changed Everything. Today, I'm excited to have Ted Murphy, a fellow Murphy, no relation, though we're, you know, all brethren together here. Ted Murphy is the CEO of IZEA Worldwide. IZEA is the largest influencer marketing platform in the world. So, Ted, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
So, Ted, I was reading up a little bit on you and some of your experiences in the past, and this is your sixth adventure, or your sixth venture as a serial entrepreneur. That's incredible. So, was this a life goal, or is this just kind of randomly how this played out?
Well, I come from a family of entrepreneurs. It's really kind of all I've ever known. I watched my dad have everything from a furniture store to a radio station to... He developed special gear for cars. He took two companies public. He was just kind of always doing something and trying something new. And as a result, that's what I thought people did. And, you know, I watched my dad go through lots of ups and downs over his career. You know, there's a story that my dad likes to tell me. And he didn't actually tell me this for the first time until I was almost in my 40s. But when he was going to take his first company public, he had so little money left that he was literally burning our furniture to keep us warm in the fireplace.
That's incredible.
And it's just, you know, it's part of my DNA, I guess, and been through lots of ups and downs over the years.
Was there a moment where it just became clear that this is what you were going to do as well?
I started my first company when I was in high school. I started selling t-shirts to my classmates, and at the time I didn't actually have enough money to print the t-shirts. So I had this design that I had come up with. I brought it around on a piece of paper to my classmates. You know, it was my version of Kickstarter, I guess. I took pre-orders and took their money. And once I had enough money, I actually started printing the t-shirts. And then I eventually wound up expanding to other schools in the area, other high schools in the area. And then actually almost got expelled because
Really? How did that happen? I have to know.
Yeah, the school didn't take too kindly to me selling my wares and such.
Look who's laughing now. You went from t-shirts to influencer marketing. You know, tell me, how did you get into influencer marketing in the first place?
Yeah, there were a couple jumps in between. The reason that we started IZEA was that prior to this, I had a interactive agency that I had started in 1999. And this was at a time where the majority of the websites that were on the internet were pretty basic HTML. A lot of people didn't focus on the user experience. And so I created a company that was all about creating high-end websites. At the time, people still had very slow internet connections. Video streaming was not really a thing. And we would build these really complex multimedia websites and online games for brands like Burger King and Coors. And these brands would spend a lot of money to build out these huge experiences, but then they didn't really have a great way of spreading the word. So I started a practice inside the company called eSeeding, where we would reach out to people on message boards and very early bloggers and people who are MySpace users, and we would get them to talk about the sites that we were launching. And sometimes we would give them nothing, and sometimes we would give them like a $50 gift card to Red Lobster. And what we found was that it was incredibly powerful. It could drive a huge amount of traffic, but it was a lot of manual effort. So I decided that I had all these resources. I had all these developers that were already working on client projects. And I said, you know what, I'm going to actually take some of those resources and devote them internally to building a platform that can allow these transactions to happen online. I was a big eBay user at the time, and I was like, look, I need to create a marketplace where the buyers are marketers and the sellers are, at the time it was primarily bloggers. And in 2006, we launched paperpost.com, and that was the very first influencer marketplace.
Incredible. So a marketplace for bloggers, a marketplace for influencers.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
That was the idea was, you know, we were providing matchmaking services basically. It's basically our same model today. Our buyers are marketers, our sellers are online influencers, and people get paid on a per post basis to create content for brands and then post it to their social accounts.
There's a leap of faith, even though you're a serial entrepreneur and this, you know, being your sixth venture, there's a leap of faith I have to assume in making a decision that you're going to move forward. Like I've been on the phone with you for 10 minutes now, and it seems like you're somebody who has a lot of ideas, who sees between the lines and how something could be profitable. How do you know if it's the right decision to move forward with a venture, let's say like IZEA?
You don't.
It's a great answer.
I mean, you never really know. I mean, the best ideas you don't know. You can't know because they haven't necessarily been done before. Now, when we created PaperPost, there was nothing like it. I couldn't point to something else to say, like, oh, that's working over there, so this should work. And when we first launched the platform, it was met with all sorts of criticism and just outrage. I mean, bloggers were going crazy because at that time, there wasn't really any advertising in social media. People thought that it was going to be pure. We were monetizing before Twitter. We monetized Twitter before Twitter monetized Twitter. And we introduced this idea of commercialization and sponsored content. And it really rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And in the early days, we would get shut down by legal teams. They were concerned of whether if brands could do this, if they were going to get fined by the FTC. So we actually had to create all the regulatory framework. I actually worked with the FTC on the initial .com disclosures, but there was nothing to say that this was going to work. I mean, if you talk to the team members that were around here in the early days, I mean, the fact that we are still around here 14 years later is just because we have always believed in what we're doing. But there was no market indicator to tell me that, yeah, this is going to work and this is going to be successful.
What's the process for turning people into believers for your vision for what IZEA could be?
I think a key in getting people bought into a vision is having them participate in the vision and the creative process. You know, I am just one guy at the end of the day who can have a big vision, but also recognizes that without all the people that build the product and market the product and sell the product, it's not going to be successful. So I think, you know, making people part of that collaborative process, giving people a voice in that process, and giving people recognition for their contributions is really, really important. I'm also a big believer that culture varies very much so matters for companies. if people aren't passionate about what they're doing and aren't happy at work, they're not going to do a good job and they're not going to stay with you for a long time. And I think that we've got a pretty good track record of attracting great talent and keeping that talent. We've had people that have been working with us for over a decade, which is like unheard of. I have someone who is working for me right now who was an intern at my last company.
Incredible.
So he and I have been working together for almost 20 years now. But you know that I think that the reason that those types of relationships exist is because the people feel empowered to contribute to the collective goal.
Influencer marketing is a really interesting topic. I want to circle back to that for a minute. When I was researching this episode, I was looking at Isaiah, I was looking at, you know, even just going to Twitter and looking up influencers. So when I say influencer marketing, the first thing I think of is just to be honest, you know, 17-year-olds on cell phones filming TikTok dances to, you know, DaBaby tracks and broadcasting, you know, like Hype House in LA and, you know, that recent documentary Jawline on Hulu, which was incredibly interesting. That's just one piece of the pie, though. Help me understand and define what is influencer marketing and what is it? Why does it matter today?
But I think that what you're seeing there is the part of influencer marketing that gets very sensationalized or gets looked at in a way where people kind of write it off as people just messing around, having fun. This is not like a serious career. I can tell you from my chair, the people that are part of our network that I get most excited about working with are, you know, they're stay-at-home moms. They are people that are mid-career. They are people that are passionate about any given subject. They take their craft very seriously. They invest a lot of time and resources in it. They're basically their own publisher. You know, it's what we're seeing now is just a hyper fragmentation of content creation and content consumption. And anybody that is passionate about something and has some creativity can build their own following. The challenge for those people is how do you monetize it? And with CPMs declining and really not a lot of money in traditional display advertising anymore, sponsorships are how a lot of these people are able to make a living and continue to invest in making content. So yes, you know, the Kardashians get all of the attention, but the brand sponsorship deals that are happening on a daily basis tend to be more with people that are not quite so sensational, but are really passionate content creators that produce content that rivals many media companies and ad agencies. And that's frankly why a lot of brands are investing in this now, is that it's not just about the followers or the likes. It's about outsourcing a lot of content creation. And they get the benefit of high quality assets being produced by somebody who's passionate about the brand, as well as the distribution that comes from their social following.
Is there a layer of trust that's built in with that as well?
I think there is. There's definitely a layer of trust. There's a layer of trust. There's a layer of affinity with the people that are creating the content. I think that that's why disclosure and transparency is so important. That's been something that I've been beating the drum on for well over a decade now. It's still, in my opinion, one of the biggest challenges with the entire industry is that a lot of these sponsorship deals are not properly disclosed. There hasn't been a lot of enforcement by the FTC. And so people feel like they can just put whatever they want out there and they're not really going to be fined or have any sort of But it does have repercussions for the creator. If their audience doesn't feel like they can trust them, if they don't feel like they're doing, you know, sponsorships and talking about products in a way that's authentic, then ultimately that creator will lose their audience and their ability to monetize.
You start a website, you have this idea, it's this, you know, moment of brilliance where you see the potential here of basically an eBay style marketplace for influencers. Originally, it just sounded like, you know, from what you said, there were a lot of bloggers early on. And that was, you know, that was really where some of the potential existed more than any place else. Today, it's a common term. You know, you work with a tremendous number of influencers on your site. You know, in my mind, I'm seeing this just, you know, amazing curve go up from early origins to where you are today. But from what you said earlier too, there are a lot of ups and downs along the way. Could you tell me about you know, maybe one of the most pivotal or challenging moments that you faced as a business?
This company was born in June of 2006. In December of 2007, the recession hit. The housing bubble burst. And I had taken on some venture funding at that point, and the VCs came in to me and said, we are going to cut off your arms and we're going to cut off your legs and we're going to see if you can still swim. I'll never forget it.
Wow.
And we took the company from about 50 people to 25 people. And it was incredibly painful. I mean, a lot of these people had just been hired. It didn't look so good at that time. It's very weird right now to be going through the same cycle now with coronavirus and just looking at the economic devastation that's happening everywhere. And it feels like we're going through the same cycle again. But we were able to make it through that because I think that we were smart in the way that we did our adjustments and, you know, cut back the staff, not just the quantity, but the types of people that we kept on board. And we didn't lose sight of what we were trying to accomplish. It's very easy once you go through something like that to just kind of feel like everything is failing around you and there's no hope. But we were able to keep the hope of what we were trying to accomplish. We actually launched some new platforms during the recession, which, you know, a lot of people don't really think about launching new products when their current business is in trouble. We actually launched several products during that time, and that helped us pick up new types of customers that we didn't have before, and that's what helped us get through. It made us move faster. It made us be more gritty in what we were trying to, in the way that we were managing our own expenses and the types of marketing that we were doing. And I think that a lot of those experiences that we had a decade ago are going to now help us get through this, which is, you know, looks like it's going to be even more challenging than the last time that we went through this cycle.
I want to touch a little more on the word hope that you use there. You mentioned some, you know, tactical business techniques that you were able to use to stay afloat as a business. And you mentioned launching some additional products, which is incredible. You're able to do it through that period with limited staff, et cetera. How did you keep hope alive with a business going through the circumstances that you were?
One of the things I've always told my team is that you've got to celebrate the small wins. When you are building a product or when you're in sales or when you're running a marketing campaign, a lot of times you are met with failure. You know, things don't quite work the way you expected them to work. A lot of times people focus on those failures and they'll invest, I think, too much time trying to dissect why things have failed. But on the other side, when things succeed and things go right, they don't celebrate they don't go through the same postmortem of why did that go right? Everybody always does postmortems of like, why did that go wrong? And I think that when you focus on why things went right, that is what can build hope. Even if it's a small win, you've got to celebrate that smaller win. You've got to invest time figuring out what created that win and then build on that win to ultimately get momentum and escape velocity. Otherwise, you're just going to continue to focus on the things that are negatives. And, you know, it becomes kind of an echo chamber of just, you know, you're always hearing about the bad things because the bad things are usually greater in magnitude and greater in frequency. You've got to kind of switch the conversation so that you're also celebrating the same frequency of the wins that you're having each day.
Having gone through this situation, what was that moment where you felt your head come above the water, where you knew everything was going to be okay for IZEA, that your business was able to move forward?
I'm waiting for it.
Great answer, Ted. No, that's a great answer.
I think that the second you feel like everything is okay is the second that everything falls apart. You know, that doesn't mean that, again, I'm not celebrating those wins and saying like, oh, man, I remember when we sold our first $1,000 deal and our first $10,000 deal and our first $1 million deals. And those were great, but it's like, all right, we got the $1 million deal. Now, how do we use what we learned there to go get, you know, the $1.5 million deal, the $2 million deal? But I don't think that you get to a point where you feel like everything is okay. Not in today's world. The second that you let off the gas is when your competitor starts to eat your lunch. My dad actually has a great saying. He says, when you're green, you grow. When you're ripe, you rot. And I always just try to stay green. I always look at what we are doing here is always in its infancy. It's always changing. We don't know what all the answers are. And we can't ever stop pushing because there's another guy that's, you know, sitting in his college dorm room who's saying, oh, I'm looking at what those guys are doing. How am I going to beat them? How am I going to move faster? How am I going to approach the market differently? And that's why I also believe that it's important to constantly invest in technology and trying out new products, even though a lot of those products are destined to fail. You know, we always have something that we are working on our Skunkworks team. Like with PaperPost, I couldn't point to something to say, this is how big this can be. This is what the market is, because there wasn't anything that existed for it. And a lot of the things that we've continued to roll out, there hasn't necessarily been a market for when we rolled it out. But we gotta try, and if it doesn't work, you also have to be willing to dismantle it as quick as possible. And you can't get too emotionally attached.
You mentioned, that with some of the adjustments that moving forward with coronavirus and the situation that's happening globally right now. My question for you is around, you know, your team now, you're all working from home now, I believe for a couple of weeks now, you've adjusted to working from home. What has that experience been like? And have there been any learnings from the last couple of weeks alone?
It's definitely been a surreal experience. I never thought that I would live through something like this. I think that our team has really taken this challenging situation and made the best that we can of it. I think a lot of that has to do with the foundation that we've laid over the past decade of really building a resilient culture and creating an environment where people truly feel like this is their extended family. I couldn't imagine trying to do this 10 years ago when the technology wasn't there to allow conversations to happen and for people to see each other face to face. I think that video conferencing is such a huge asset, and I never realized how important it was until we couldn't meet face to face. Even though we had a distributed team before, it always kind of seemed like something that was novel in a way. It's like, oh, we're gonna go meet with the team that's in India, right? And it's like, oh, that's cool, they're in India. And now it's like, no, this person's literally in Orlando, but I can't go see them. The only way we're going to communicate is through video conferencing. I'd be lying if I said that it hasn't been without its challenges, but I feel like we're doing a pretty good job of adjusting. And, you know, I'm really proud of the extra effort that the team has put forward to continue to make our culture a big part of the communication that's happening between our team members. It's not just work. You know, we're still trying to have fun and do the things that we used to do. Next week is actually our spirit week, and people are going to be dressed up all week, just like we used to in the office. And I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent. Well, Ted, this has been a great conversation. It's really interesting hearing how you approach these businesses, hearing how you went through the difficult circumstances you did, and, you know, kind of came through on top here. Any final thoughts for those listening? Anything you would want people to know, you know, especially given the circumstances we're under today?
I think that whether you're an entrepreneur listening to this on the other side, or you were somebody who's working at a company led by an entrepreneur, you know, it's sometimes really difficult to see what the future holds and how an event like this can actually craft a better outcome at the end of the day. But I believe that events like this make you really focus on the things that are important, both in your professional life as well as your personal life. I've spent more time with my wife and child in the past month than I probably have in like past 6 months, which has been awesome. And I also think that the time that I spend with my colleagues is just, it's more productive and it's more focused because we know that, you know, we are all under the gun and that these are every decision that we make right now is incredibly critical. I am very optimistic that our company is going to come out of this on the other side of a better, stronger company. I am confident that I'm going to come out the other side of this a better, stronger entrepreneur, and that my teammates are also going to come out stronger on the other side. And I even think, you know, my child, while I would love to have my child in school right now, I think that he's learning things at home that he would have never learned at school. And so I'm excited for him and how this experience shapes his life.
Great words there, Ted. Thank you so much for joining me today.